Good morning once again. Welcome. As they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. They compelled him to bear his cross, and when he had come to a place called Golgotha, that is to say, the place of the skull, they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink. And when he had tasted it, he would not drink. And they crucified him and divided his garments, casting lots, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet. They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. And sitting down, they kept watch over him there. They put up over his head the accusation written against him, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Then two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right hand, the other on the left. And those who passed by blasphemed him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. If you're the Son of God, come down from the cross." Likewise, the chief priests also, mocking with the scribes and the elders, said, "He saved others. Himself he cannot save. If he's the King of Israel, let him now come down from the cross, and we'll believe him. He trusted in God. Let him deliver him now if he will have him. For he said, 'I'm the Son of God.'" Even the robbers who were crucified with him reviled him with the same thing. Now from the sixth hour till the ninth hour, there was darkness over the land. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani?" That is, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" Some of those who stood there, when they heard that, said, "This man's calling for Elijah." And immediately one of them ran and took a sponge and filled it with sour wine, put it on a reed, and gave it to him to drink. And the rest said, "Let him alone. Let him see if Elijah will come to save him." Jesus, when he had cried out again with a loud voice, yielded up his spirit. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from the top to the bottom, and the earth quaked, and the rocks were split, and the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the graves after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. Now when the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and the things that had happened, they feared greatly, saying, "Truly, this was the Son of God." Jesus suffering as a suitable sacrifice for sins is portrayed not only in the scriptures, but it's portrayed in books, movies. Surely you've heard of Mel Gibson's The Passion of Christ. And that word passion is suffering. And there's no doubt that he suffered for us. You think about the treatment that he received when he was beaten with what we would call a cat of nine tails, like the pirates used. A whip, multi-stranded, but with bits of bone or stone, metal tied to the end of it, so that it would not only bruise, but tear and gash the flesh. And by the time they had scourged Jesus, he was a bloody mess. And then they wove a crown of thorns and pressed it down upon his head. And any of you who've ever suffered or seen a head wound know that when you get cut around the head, you bleed profusely. They beat him in the face so that he was probably discolored, puffed up. I don't know whether any of you fellas, the ladies, I can't imagine, but maybe some of you guys watch boxing or mixed martial arts, maybe witnessed a fist fight. You know what happens when the eyes puff up and lips puff up and are split. Ear gets torn a little bit. And you know how ugly it is and how brutal it looks when someone's beaten about the face, but that's what happened to our Lord. And as we've celebrated this morning, in memory of him, and his sacrifice for our sins, surely our minds have gone back and thought just for a moment about the brutality that he suffered. And surely each of us thought, it was for me. It was for me. And yet this same Jesus, while suspended between heaven and earth, looked out upon the people who were mocking him, who were blaspheming him, who were cursing him, and who had nailed him to that cross, and said, God, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Our subject this morning is the compassion of Jesus. Not the passion of Jesus, although that's what we've just talked about, that's what we've just memorialized in the Lord's Supper. Not his suffering in the sense of suffering physical and mental pain and anguish and torment as a result of the crucifixion. Not his passion, but his compassion. Compassion. And I left my recharge clicker down here. Our theme is Christ-driven. We talked about it in class. If you were not here for class, let me quickly say that we noted, as is on the chart, that Jesus said, and I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to me. We understand that his great love, his death for us, his giving of himself freely for us, not for his own sin, but for the sins of others he died, for us, for me. We noted that the Apostle Paul is a wonderful example of someone who appreciated who Jesus was and what he did. The Apostle Paul is the one that said, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Paul understood. It was for me. For me. Because of his compassion. In Matthew chapter 9, verse 35, we read, and Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and preaching the gospel of the kingdom, healing every sickness and every disease among the people. But when he saw the multitudes, he was moved by compassion for them. Then he said to his disciples, the harvest is truly plenteous, but the laborers are few. Pray therefore the Lord of the harvest that he will send forth laborers into the harvest. As he beheld the ignorant masses of people made up of all kinds, varying degrees of faith, from various places in life, he looked generally at people and had compassion on them. He knew they were sheep without a shepherd, that they were as lambs for the slaughter because Satan was busy. Even the most religious people, the straitest sect of the Jews, the Pharisees, would later be characterized as scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. That they were zealous, there's no doubt about that. Jesus said that they would go about land and sea, encompass land and sea to make one proselyte, and then when they'd done that, they'd make him twofold a son of hell as themselves. Now, folks, that's strong language, isn't it? They were evangelistic. The Pharisees were. There's no doubt about that. It's clear that they wanted other people to be Pharisees. Paul was a Pharisee. His zeal grew up in the teaching of Phariseeism. They were the separated ones, and they started out with a very good message. It was, quit being like the world around you, especially the Grecian world around them. Quit acting like you're not the people of God. Come out from among them and be separate, saith the Lord, would be their message. But they lost their way. And I want to be sure that we don't lose ours. They begin to have no compassion at all for people that they considered to be below them. When Jesus ate with sinners, they immediately called it to his attention. When Jesus was around tax collectors, the publicans, the despised publicans, when he welcomed a woman of sin in Simon the Pharisee's house, and she washed his feet with her tears. Was she a sinner? No doubt about it. And so Simon says, if he knew what kind of woman that was, he wouldn't allow her anywhere near him. If he knew what kind of woman that was, how in the world could he allow her to get that close to him? He must not be what he claims. Simon, I've got something to say to you. The Lord knew his thoughts. Jesus had more compassion on her because. Why? Because she loved. She knew who she was. She knew she had sin. She realized it. All right, the Lord then was compassionate toward us. He realized their ignorance, their lack of guidance. He felt an immense sense of empathy for them. Not that he'd ever been there, but he understood. He's a high priest who is indeed touched with the feeling of our infirmity. In Matthew's account, Jesus next sends out the 12 to preach the gospel. In the Mark account, they've just returned and given account of the things that they've experienced during the preaching tour. A little bit of chronological difference there in the two as they recount these events. Jesus calls them to come with him to a deserted place, but the crowd follows. And when Jesus sees them, he has compassion. And so, not only did he state what he said, but he also feeds them. In John chapter 6, when they pursued Jesus after his feeding of the multitude, he gives his wonderful bread of life sermon. And he's saddened in heart when after he preaches to them, except you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no part in you. I'm the bread of heaven. I'm the bread of life. They went back, many of his disciples went back, and they walked with him no more, and he was brokenhearted over that. Jesus had compassion that we'll never know. The depth of emotion. I know he gave us our emotions. He gave us our heart. He gave us our minds. But I think it's difficult for us to try to see the kind of compassion that it would take to give up your only begotten Son for sinful mankind. Compassion is defined as to spare, to have pity, to have compassion on. There are several passages. I've got a few up on the board. You remember Pharaoh's daughter? She saw the child. She had compassion on him, took him to her own household. There are several Old Testament passages. 2 Samuel 12 and verse 6. Making sure that my overhead and my notes are exactly the same. And he shall restore fullfold the lamb because he did these things and because he had no pity. David said the man's going to be put to death and he's going to restore. David had compassion on the man who had the little ewe lamb. And the old other man came and took it, killed it, and fed it to his guest. You remember that? David's passion boiled up because his compassion for the man whose little ewe lamb that was his pet was taken away from him. We know the rest of that story. Do I have to say it? That he should have had compassion on Uriah the Hittite. He should have had a passion for the law that forbade everything that he was doing when he was not himself, when he was not behaving like a man after God's own heart. There's another Hebrew word used in this text. Psalm 78:38, but he being full of compassion forgave their iniquity and did not destroy them. Yes, many a time he turned his anger away and did not stir up his wrath. In Psalm 78:39, for he remembered that they were but flesh, a breath that passes away and does not come again. And in Psalm 86 and verse 15, but you, O Lord, listen, you, O Lord, are a God of compassion and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in mercy and truth. And then Isaiah 49 and 15. Can a woman forget her nursing child and not have compassion on the son of her womb? Surely they may forget. But I will not forget you. I have you engraven on the palms of my hands. I cannot read that passage without thinking about Jesus. Whether or not it has reference to the crucifixion, I don't know. Not sure about that. But it sure paints a picture, doesn't it? Look at my hands, Jesus said to his apostles. Look at my hands. Touch me. Feel me. A spirit doesn't have flesh and blood as you see that I have. What do you think was going through their minds as they looked at Jesus? What do you think went through the mind of Thomas? Well, you know pretty much what went through his mind, don't you, when he realized, seeing the hole in the side of the resurrected Lord, that it was the truth. Truth. I'm the truth, Jesus said. I'm the life. I'm living. I died, but I'm alive again. Touch me. Feel me. It's the truth. You know Thomas's reaction. My Lord and my God. All right, compassion then. I have you engraven on the palms of my hand. Mothers may forget their nursing child, but I'll not forget you. So, there are several passages in the New Testament as well. I'm not going to read those now. I want to read on. And talk to you a little bit about the difference between us and Jesus. I'll tell you what happens to us. You've been watching the news. Surely you have seen the riots in Ferguson. Current event going on. The death of the young man at the hands of the police officer. I haven't seen the latest news. I don't know yet what happened. I don't know whether the officer feared for his life. I don't know whether he was a bully with a gun. I don't know what happened. But a young man died. And I'll tell you what happens when we see things like that and the reaction, the rioting, in the Trayvon Martin case. When we see people on the street corners, you go down to Houston and you go to the right places, you will see people and you know they are in a drug-dazed state where they really don't know what in the world is going on. Men standing on the street corner, like I saw recently, they're just out of our neighborhood. So I was heading home, there's a guy on the street corner with a sign. And I don't mean to be crude when I tell you this, but his sign said, "Too honest to steal, too ugly to prostitute." And as I went by, my thought was, "And too lazy to work." But I judged him. Immediately judged him. And I didn't have any compassion on him because I didn't like his sign. I want to tell you, our reactions, because we become jaded, don't we? We see all of this stuff. We become hardened and calloused and we're jaded and we refuse to have sympathy with people who need sympathy. And often we're not as compassionate as our Lord would be to other people. They brought it on themselves, we say. He did it to himself. We're not compassionate with people who are swaddled up in sin, who are living a lifestyle of sin that we know is repugnant to God, and it's repugnant to us. And rather than feeling sorry for the state that they're in and for their souls, knowing that they're going to go to hell if they don't change their way, we turn the other way, go the other way, and say they're getting exactly what they deserve. And I'm afraid of that attitude. I'm afraid we become hardened. I'm afraid I do. And we do. As I said, we become jaded and calloused and we become cynical. We're so caught up in politics. We're Texans. What else? You know, we're going to get caught up in that kind of stuff. And for the most part, we're pretty independent. I'm native Texan. Proud of it, you know. You know what they say about Texans, right? You can always tell a Texan. You just can't tell him much. You know, that may be true. Some of the finest people I know are Texans. Not all Texans are bad. Okay, get off of that. But I tell you, a lot of my fellow Texans, if you read Facebook, if you read blogs, if you read the news, if you listen to politicians, if you're around much, not much sympathy for people who are steeped in ignorance, vice, sin, ungodly lifestyles. We get so caught up in our minds with regard to moral and spiritual filth that pretty soon we're kind of like the Pharisees were when they just don't want to be around anybody else. Period. And whatever people are getting, we feel like that's what they deserve. We're not like Jesus in that regard. And I think we need to be. If I'm lifted up from the earth, I will draw all men to me. But nobody sees him lifted up from the earth today. It has to be painted in word pictures, doesn't it? It has to be told to other people what the Lord has done. And the good things that come as a result of the bad things that happen to him. And who's going to do that? Well, you, Byron, you're a preacher. That's what you get paid for, right? Isn't that right? Who's going to tell? Who's going to step out of their way to go and see a man bleeding and broken on the side of the road? We don't need priests and Levites today. I say that tongue in cheek. I understand that we are all priests, that we're a holy and royal priesthood, but we ought to be the kind that would stop and help, not the kind that'll pass by on the other side. What am I trying to get at this? I'm trying to get us to open up our hearts for the lost and dying of the world. Yes, we've got people that are repugnant, that use bad language, that smell bad, that do bad things. I know there are bullies out there. I know there are robbers out there. I know there are drug addicts out there. I know there are lying politicians. Are there any other kind? But lying politicians out there. There are lawyers out there. There are all kinds of people out there. We can't just be separated from them. If we go into all the world, we're going to rub elbows with people who are sinners. People who are mean, who are mean-spirited. We can't become so jaded that we hold the truth in our hearts but never share it with anybody else. We're going to have to learn to be compassionate to other people, like Jesus was. We need to be willing to understand people. We had a fellow who was our realtor. Didn't learn until after he became our realtor. This is a while back in our past. We did not learn that he was a homosexual, gay, is what the word they prefer, until after we had dealt with him for a little while, and then I began to, I got the idea. He didn't introduce himself. That wasn't on his business card. And I invited him to church, and he said, will your church let people like me come? I said, what do you mean people like you? And he was beginning to get the idea that I knew that he was a homosexual. And I said, yeah, why wouldn't we invite people like you? And so we had a long conversation about that. And later on, I had to reiterate that I was opposed to that, and that the Bible taught, God taught us through His Word that kind of activity is sinful. It's wrong. But he was a good guy, a nice guy. What I'm trying to say, he was a nice fellow. He seemed to be as honest as the day was long, courteous and kind. Been brought up by Baptist parents, but he was deceived. I believe with all of my heart he was deceived into thinking that there was something genetically different in him than anyone else. I believe he was wrong about that. But I believe he'd been convinced. And I had to tell him, even if that were so, which possibly it may, even if it were so that there's a genetic predisposition, it's still described in the Word of God as sinful behavior. You've got to stop that. Please understand why I'm telling you this. It's not because I'm trying to toot my own whistle or anything like that. I have been as prejudiced in my life as anybody else has. And I've been callous toward people like other people have. That same fellow came to us and wanted to make a donation to the church to help us build our building because he said, I think you and Sharon do it right. How did he get the idea? Why did he want to do that? Simply because somebody took the time to tell him he was lost and a sinner, but didn't, you know, give it this, I don't want to be anywhere close to you kind of attitude. You know, some of the most miserable people on earth are people who are addicted to alcohol. I know we've had it in our family in times past. They're some of the most miserable people on earth with the lowest self-esteem, and so they're the loudest, the most braggadocious, the ones who want to whip everybody, but inside they're dying because they know they're addicted and they can't handle their own addiction. What do we do to them? We make jokes about them. We shun them. We don't show compassion for them. I just use these as illustrations to say that we need to learn to be compassionate for those who are lost, to be sympathetic with someone who's lost and dying in sin, to understand that people can be so programmed in their thinking to be far from the Lord and often thinking they're doing the Lord a service. Have you seen the cartoons that are taught by Hamas to their children? The cartoon characters they use. So that they will be sure. By the way, one of their cartoon characters was killed off. He looked a lot like Mickey Mouse. But he was killed off. You know how he was killed off? By the wicked Jews. And so the next cartoon character comes on and tells them he's not here anymore. He was killed. He was killed by the Jews. And they grow up with that kind of hatred for people, that kind of distortion in their minds. I tell you, we're not sympathetic. I'll give you one more illustration, and I'll tell you something that bothers me a lot. I guess I'm as patriotic as just about anybody. I don't think I'm less patriotic than anyone. I'm a supporter of our soldiers who defend us. No one supports them any more than I do. But it sure strikes me as a difficult, difficult thing for young men to join up and then be taught that other people are no more than animals and that you must never hesitate to pull the trigger. Man, woman, or child, if they're a threat. And then expect them to come back after that duty overseas and to be a faithful Christian and have sympathy with people you need to study with. It's tough. I can't imagine how difficult that transition must be. And to have them sympathetic with their Muslim neighbors who need the Lord. It's tough. We need to have compassion on people, if we're Christians. And that's another thing about this compartmentalizing our lives, so that we say, well, we put our Christianity over here, and I'm very compassionate for people because of that. But over here, I'm an American, and I've got every right to hate those people. You've got to be careful about that. As a Christian, we need to be careful about that. So, it's not that we condone sin. It's not that we condone weakness. We need to be compassionate with our brethren. I've got a lot of brethren that I disagree with on some things. We probably all do. And while I will not tolerate false teaching, I am tolerant of my brethren. Why? Because I have compassion on them. At least I ought to. I don't always practice that, by the way. If I were totally consistent in that, it'd be great. But I'm not always totally consistent in that. I have emotions just like everybody else. I'm judgmental just like everybody else. He ought to know better than that. Teach something like that. He's got more brains than that. You know, we all have those kind of feelings well up in us and everything. But if we were a little bit more willing to just talk with brethren, study with them, pray with them, we might get rid of some of our differences. A lot of our differences are magnified because we lose our temper. I recall a debate a few years ago where two guys who were both friends of mine were debating on the deity and humanity of Christ. And they were so ugly to each other, it was embarrassing, so demeaning, that it was just horrible to be there and listen to this. And they were debating the deity and humanity of the Prince of Peace. Just think about that for a moment. It drives me nuts. It really does. Well, I was a little nuts already, but that's all right. Jesus could sympathize with us. Hebrews 5 and 2. If a Levitical priest could be sympathetic with the people he served, surely priest in the kingdom of Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace. You know, when the angels sang, peace on earth, goodwill toward men, he wasn't talking about the cessation of all wars between nations. We know there'll be wars and rumors of wars, and they're going to continue. And things will wax worse and worse. But we're in one body where there's neither Jew nor Greek or bond or free. We're supposed to be at peace with one another. It'll never happen if we're not sympathetic with one another. We've lost, I think, the compassion for other people that we ought to have, that Jesus had for all of us. So what did Jesus do? He didn't just feel for people, he did something about it. When they were ignorant, he taught them. When they were hungry, he fed them. When people were sick, had loved ones who were sick, he healed them. He raised the dead. Now, obviously, we can't do that. We can't do miracles. But I'll tell you what we can do. How many of us are compassionate enough to go to some elderly person who is sick and needing help and are willing to empty their bedpan? Well, we're not turned on to that kind of thing. And nobody likes the hospital or nursing home smell. Nobody likes that. Nobody likes to go and talk to someone who is suffering, who maybe doesn't have all their mind quite like they used to. Have a little bit of compassion. You may be there one of these days. Did you ever see an older person, maybe in an assisted living or in a nursing home, how their eyes light up when the children come in? Take the kids in and let them see them. You'll make their day, and they'll make yours in return. We can do a lot of things. We need to be moved with compassion for the needs of others, whether physical or spiritual. When, Lord, did we see you sick or in prison? Hungry, naked, thirsty, destitute. When did we see any of this? Well, when you did it to the least of one of these, my brethren. And surely you know the story of the Good Samaritan. All of us do. James chapter 2. Judgment without mercy. Compassion on your brother. We use James chapter 2 to try to defeat the doctrine of the faith-only folks. And then argue with them that we're justified by works and not by faith only. That's what it says. The illustration that's given, or the doctrine that's given, the reason for the teaching, the illustration, obviously, Abraham and Rahab the harlot, great illustrations of people of faith in time past whose faith caused them to work. Great, we understand all of that. But back up a few verses and see that it has to do with the way we treat our brethren. James is saying, you tell me about your faith, that's one thing. You say you've got faith, that's great. But I'll show you my faith by what I do. Show your compassion by what you do. In the spiritual realm, if you feel sorry for somebody who's lost, teach them. Teach them. Teach them, teach them, teach them. Brethren who've turned their back on the Lord, involved in sin, we're going to withdraw them eventually. Sometimes it's like pulling teeth to get the church to take any action. But finally we do that. Why? Because we're vindictive and we'll make sure they get theirs and we're going to show them? Of course not. We want to shame them into repentance. I have a brother back in San Antonio who tells a story of a man down in another town, who had left the faith. And they were trying to withdraw him, and the church was working toward that end. The elders were working toward that end. And he had gone to see him several times, and they were just about to go ahead and withdraw him. And this fellow said, "Let's go talk to him one more time. Come go with me. We'll go talk to him one more time." And they went over and pled with the brother to straighten his life up and everything. The following Sunday, he came down the aisle, tears in his eyes, with a broken heart, acknowledging his sin, his wrong, his desire to be restored. One more time is all it took. Don't give up. Don't give up on your brethren. Have a little compassion. In the physical realm, help those people you can help. We spend a lot of time fussing with our brethren over what we can do with money out of the treasury when we've got money in our pocket that we could use to feed people who are starving and we don't use it. Now, work that over in your minds just for a moment. And I realize, and I argue as strongly as anyone, that we have authorized activities for the local church, and we're limited to those things that for which we can find authority in the Scriptures. I am not fussing about that at all. But once having that established, but what about as an individual? We are free to help who we want to help, are we not? We can even help a Samaritan. Even Texans, no matter how repugnant we may be. Who's your neighbor? Friends, who's your neighbor? You know. It's the person who needs your help. First John 3:17 says, "Whoso hath this world's goods and seeth his brother in need and shut up his bowels of compassion from him, how dwelleth the love of God in him?" 1 Corinthians 12:26, "And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. Or if one member is honored, all the members are honored with it." Once again, remember Paul on Mars Hill. He was walking around the city and he ended up there at the Areopagus. He was moved with compassion for the people because of their ignorance in their idol worship. And he wasn't satisfied to walk away and saying, "Those ignorant Grecians, boy, they're going to get theirs when judgment comes." Help them. Have compassion. You want to be like Jesus. If you want to be a follower of Jesus, have the compassion He had for you drive you to do His will. Now, I haven't talked much about this except at the very beginning, but there may be somebody here this morning who realizes how compassionate the Lord has been, how patient He's been. You're still alive and you've never obeyed the gospel of Christ. The Lord hasn't forgotten you. You're engraved on the palms of His hands. The nail prints are there. The scar is there. The compassion is there. "Come unto me," He said, "all you who labor and are heavy laden, I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I'm meek and lowly in heart, and you'll find rest for your souls." Would you find rest for your soul this morning? Would you obey the gospel if you haven't? Or maybe you're just a Christian and you've been rocking along and you just need to think more about what you're about as a Christian. Would you be driven this morning to obey the Lord? You come while we stand and while we sing.